Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for tuning in. This is Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren. We are based out of Sweden, Scandinavia, but you can follow us from around the globe at our website, redicecreations.com. And today we have a really interesting program ahead of us. We have Hugh Montgomery with us. He is the author of The God Kings of Europe, and his latest book is called The God Kings of Utrimmer. And we are going to talk about royal bloodlines. We are going to get into the descendants of Jesus a little bit and tie this together with some of the, I guess you could say, Scandinavian dynasties, the Odinic line and also another line called Ulvungar and much more. He has a blog that you can follow along in. To go there, to check it out, rather, simply go to hughmontgomery.blogspot.com. We will also have this linked up, of course, on redicecreations.com, so you can find the links easily from there. And we do have a lot to talk about today, and I'm really excited about this, so let's bring on our guest. Welcome to the program, Hugh. Very nice to have you with us today.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me on.
Thank you for spending some of your time with me and our listeners here today, and maybe we can talk a little bit about your last name to begin with, and some of your family connections to the kind of research that we're going to discuss here today. I know that you've shared with me that the Montgomery line, who first came from Scotland, was introduced as nobility, I should say, in the Swedish, as we say up here, Riddarhuset, that the House of Nobility in around, I think it was 1776. That's right, an interesting year there. So the question is, have you always been interested in this line of research, or was this something that came on later in your life, Hugh?
No, I think I've always been interested. I mean, I have to say I did a genealogy of my family. And in point of fact, at the time that I did it, I thought the Swedish line had died out. And it wasn't until I published the book and someone said to me, but you finished it at Colonel whatever it was, Montgomery. Do you know that there are descendants still around? And I said, oh, no, I don't. So someone gave me some addresses, and I got in contact with them. And lo and behold, there they were. And in fact, not only that, but they are the most direct male descendants from Roger de Montgomery, who was the 2IC of William the Conqueror, at the Battle of Hastings.
Hmm.
And they are actually the most direct in the bloodline.
Okay, interesting. And a lot of, if we're going to tie this together a little bit with some of the sources, because this is, again, a very, difficult area, I guess, to sort out, especially when we're talking about descendants of Jesus and so forth. There's so many different ideas, theories, and research around. And I want to get into a little bit what you base your research on, but as I understand it, you have a relative that himself were doing a lot of this research. Is that correct?
Indeed. Well, he's now dead, but Beau Gabriel Montgomery, who died a few years ago, in fact, back in the 1960s, I think it was, produced a book called Ancient Migrations and Royal Houses. And it was, in fact, when I went up to Sweden, and my Swedish cousin there very kindly gave me a copy of this book, and I started looking through it, and I realized that he'd done a lot of the work that I was looking at myself. So I then said, well, absolutely fabulous. Now, where did he get this information from? And lo and behold, I discovered that he had the most fabulous library with collections of documents and books and what have you, mostly about the Scottish lines and the family, but also the Belvoir and Arundel documents and so on, which are almost priceless, I would say. And it was on the basis of some of those that I was able to do a lot of the genealogies which I've done.
Mm. And how does one go about, digging into some of this material, and what are credible sources? Where do you go? I mean, again, you mentioned, of course, your relative have done a lot of his research.
Yep.
Here, but what do you know what he bases his research on?
Okay, his research was based mostly upon the Scandinavian documents, the Regis Danorum collection and the documents in the Royal Library in Stockholm and so on. So his was almost purely on the, if you like, the Norse side of it.
Yeah.
My side of it, if you like, or the bits that I have added to it, which is, if you like, the Palestinian, for want of a better word, side of it.
Mm-hmm.
Those come from a variety of sources. One of the documents, I mean, the first document I probably came across was a document that I didn't really take an awful lot of notice of, and I got this, 30 years ago, I think, or more, I came across it. And it was simply a rather nice little legend about Mary Magdalene, and I didn't think much more about it. And then, of course, the Nag Hammadi document started to be published.
Mm.
And I realized that they were backing up what this document said. So I thought, that was interesting. Let's go and have a look at it. Now, you have to understand, I'm basically a medieval historian. I was professor of history, politics, and economics at the University of Applied Sciences in Belgrade. Sorry, my throat's going a little.
No worries.
And so it was for me to go back and look at sort of documents which go back before that was something totally new to me. I mean, for example, I knew no Sahidic Coptic, and the Nag Hammadi documents are in Sahidic Coptic. I still wouldn't say I know Sahidic Coptic, but I can sort of, I would say, decode them, if that is the right word.
Mm-hmm.
I've got no idea how they're pronounced or anything like that, but I can sort of, after reading a considerable amount of them, I suppose I can decode them a little bit.
Right.
But, you know, it was a new thing for me, and I had to learn as I went along.
Absolutely. That's the way people learn, obviously. How,
sure.
There are some other thing sources that you mentioned as well at the beginning of your latest book, The God Kings of Utremer, where you, for instance, mentioned Malachi Martin, even, I think, Henry Sinclair. Is that correct?
Yeah. Okay. Let's go back there. The source documents are Eusebius, who wrote the history of the church from Christ to Constantine in the 4th century. Then there is the Abdias manuscript, which I mention in quite detail, and of which I now am the proud possessor of a complete copy, thanks to the curator of the Norris Collection in the United States.
Mm.
Now, you know, that has been sitting in there God knows how many years. I've got no idea. It's never been translated out of Latin.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people just forgot about it. But there it is. And then there are other documents which, for example, Malachi Martin, who was a professor at the a Jesuit professor at the Pontifical Biblical Institute in Rome, and he did translations, for example, of the Dead Sea Scrolls and so on. He wrote a book called The Decline and Fall of the Roman Church.
Yes.
And in that, you know, he mentions quite clearly the Desposini, who they were, the fact that they came to see Pope Sylvester and everything else. And, you know, it's not something I've made up. This is something that the Catholic Church itself acknowledges happened because it's been clearly written by people like Eusebius.
Interesting. And how far back can we go? If we look at, for instance, then the genealogical record, if we look from various sources, how far back approximately does this go in history?
That is really a very difficult question, because the first documents that I think that one can rely on is probably the Abdias manuscript, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Which was written somewhere around about 150 AD, and then was translated somewhere before 250 AD into Latin, okay?
Right.
Now, theoretically, the translator was a guy called Julius Africanus, but almost certainly he was not the translator. It was probably done by one of his scribes or something like that, but it was attributed to him, just as, for example, you know, all the epistles of guy who did the translation in the prologue says very clearly that Abdias was related to the Lord. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, unfortunately, he doesn't say how. If he did, it would make my life infinitely easier.
Right.
But the fact that he was related in some way or other means that he would know who Jesus' brothers and sisters are. And from him, we get very clearly that Jesus had a twin brother called Judas, known as Judas Thomas,
mm-hmm.
or later on simply Thomas, which simply means twin, and another full brother called Jacob or James. And it also says quite clearly that, you know, these were produced per carnum, by way of the flesh. In other words, Joseph and Mary had normal sexual intercourse. There was no question of virgin births. And presumably, if Thomas is a twin, then Jesus wasn't by virgin birth either.
Right.
You know, it's a bit difficult. He also, of course, says that Joseph, Jesus' father, had another wife called Hannah, and by her he had Simon, known as Simon Chananaeus, or Simon the Petron, another Judas, or possibly Judah, who's usually known as Zelotes, and Thaddeus. So there was another three half-brothers of Jesus as well.
Mm.
Plus, we know from the Gospel of Philip that he had a sister called Mary. So one can build up, if you like, a picture of his family.
Right.
Now, the problem that we then have is we have no genealogy from that until the eight people come to see Pope Sylvester in 318.
Hmm.
Okay, so we've gone from, let's say, for the sake of argument, the year 80 AD, right?
Yeah.
To the year 318 AD. But we do know their names, because that's mentioned. That's mentioned by Eusebius. So what I tried to do is to look at what was the likelihood of who was descended from whom.
Hmm.
To be perfectly frank, I haven't been terribly successful. I've made some suggestions, but there is simply, that is the most likely, but it's not by any means, you know, I wouldn't put hand on heart and say, well, that's what it is, because
right.
You can't do that.
Right.
There are too many gaps missing. But I have done my best and said, well, that's what I think is the likelihood. And then there was another document, which obviously was in, which I actually don't think it was a different document. I think probably that Dr. Hugh Sinclair found the same documents I have found and worked out his own genealogy from it, which, although similar to mine, does differ.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
All I have said is I've given what his genealogy says, I've given what I think it is, and I've suggested where the differences might lie and why they might be different.
Okay.
And I think mostly it's a question of names, and, for example, the name Thomas probably doesn't mean Thomas, it was probably means twin, and Germanus probably simply means brother, rather than being a name.
Okay.
Mm. And I suspect that that's the sort of differences that we've got.
So it's not too much there, and as you say, this is very much about laying the puzzle, as it were, because a lot of these pieces are lost. Do you think that there are any, I mean, again, when the Nag Hammadi library were, you know, discovered, so to speak, a lot of new information were brought to light. Do you think that we're ever going to see something like that again, where you know, new reliable sources or documentation about this will come to light? What do you think?
I think that there are at least two other documents around. I suspect that in order to bring them to light, someone's going to have to pay an awful lot of money for them. A bit like, for example, the Gospel of Judas.
Mm-hmm.
It's been known about for, what, 40, 50 years? And it was stuck in a safe deposit box for years. It got completely ruined in there, simply because someone wouldn't put up whatever it was the asking price was, £1 million or something for it.
Right, right.
Now, I suspect that there are at least a couple of other documents like that around. ever come to light or not, and if they do come to light, what state they will be in, I've got no idea.
Right, right. How about the Bible as, I guess, historical document? Are there clues in there as well?
Oh, yes, I think there are. But what one has to appreciate is that the Gospels were rewritten after 325 AD. And I mean, you know, Eusebius actually says, you know, I and my scribes sat down and rewrote them. So you have to read them with a degree of skepticism and see what was possibly in the original and what has been added to or changed. I mean, for example, von Tischendorf, when he was preparing his collection, which is now in the Strathclyde Library, he actually said, you know, he was amazed by the way that the monks had quite, you know, without even thinking about it, decided to change what the original said because it didn't conform to church dogma.
Yeah.
So one has to be very careful about it. But yes, sure, there are clues here and there in these documents. And I mean, for example, the work of Lady Drower on the Mandaeans is terribly important because it's the only extant work which gives a different story for John and says that John was considerably older than Jesus and that he was the original founder, if you like, and that Jesus merely took over after John had died.
Tell us a little bit more about the Mandaeans. This is something that has come up a little bit now and then recently in the program, and we haven't kind of discussed it that much. What do you know about the Mandaeans? And this was, as far as I understand it, pretty much a Gnostic type sect in the region of Iraq today, I guess.
Well, correct? Yeah, I mean, they're almost, I'm not sure even how many there are left, because they were almost totally wiped out by Saddam Hussein. They were the people of the sort of fens of the, you know, little rivers and so on at the southern end of Iraq on the near the Iran border, and they have their own Bible, their own belief system, and everything else, which they call in order to survive in the Muslim world, they call themselves Johannite Muslims, but strictly, I think they call themselves sort of a sect of Shia or something.
Okay,
but originally, they were called Johannite Christians.
From John the Baptist, Johannite.
From John, yes. Yeah. And as far as they're concerned, John was the Messiah, and Jesus was a false Messiah who took over and changed the word of John. And, for example, all the story about, you know, the Magnificat.
No.
You know, how does it start? Can't remember now.
Okay.
That wasn't actually said by Mary. It was originally said by Elizabeth about her son John. You know, the Lord doth magnify my name, and so on. My name doth magnify the Lord. I beg your pardon. That was actually taken straight out of there and stuck into the Gospels as if it's said by Mary. But in fact, the Church agrees that it was originally said about by Elizabeth about her son John.
Okay. That's interesting. And this is the Magnificat. For those who doesn't know this, it's a text of the.
Well, nowadays it's the sort of thing that the Roman Catholic Church almost sort of a lot of people have to sort of learn it by heart. You know, my soul doth magnify my Lord, and the. Something, God my Saviour, who hath something rather his handmaiden, so that all people shall call me blessed. I can't remember. I used to know it by heart, but it's a long time ago.
But there's possible clues here that lies within this, then, and this is, again, this is part of the Gospel of Luke, I think, right?
Yeah.
Okay, very interesting. And the importance of John the Baptist here, and again, is there? Do you think that there's an entire line, so to speak, that is connected with John the Baptist?
I do think so, yes. I mean, as I've said, I All the evidence that I've got points to Mary Magdalene being the daughter of John the Baptist.
Okay.
Now, John the Baptist was probably something like 14 years older than Jesus.
Okay.
So his daughter would have been, you know, just about the right age to marry Jesus. The point about it is that Anya, John the Baptist's wife, is called by him in one of his love poems to her, "My Pearl of Petra."
Oh, okay.
Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, that puts us straight back into the Nabataeans and the line of Petra.
Yes.
However, I can find no record that John, as such, ever became king of the Nabataeans or king of Petra.
Okay.
However, Anya is the name of one of the daughters of one of the King Aretas. I can't remember which one offhand it is. And it strikes me, therefore, likely that what actually happened, because that king only had daughters, so it's probable that he married his daughter off to John the Baptist, who was probably the Zadok priest of Petra.
Okay.
Now, one of the other things that's become very clear is that the Petrans were very much Zadoks as opposed to, shall we say, Sadducean-type Jews. Okay?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the Zadok priesthood was the one that sort of, to a very large extent, I think, controlled things there. So it wouldn't be unsurprising if the daughter of the king married the high priest, and that they had then a daughter called Miriam.
Okay.
Now, what I've suggested is that, in point of fact, John, because he was not directly, what should we say, he wasn't directly descended from the kings there, would have had to probably prove himself as, what should we say, prince regent in the name of his wife.
Okay.
And the Bible suggests that John went into the desert and disappeared for years, etc., etc., etc. Why? Because they don't want to admit where he actually was, which was probably making a royal tour of the Nabataean and Sabbatean Empire, which extended right through into modern Ethiopia, and in fact included the hill fortress of what's now called Magdala.
Okay.
So, now, almost certainly he would have been accompanied by Anya, because after all, it wasn't in his own name that he was there, it was in only as her husband. So, my thinking on this is that, therefore, whilst they were away, which probably took several years, a daughter was born to them into or near Magdala, and she was given the name of Miriam. She became known as Miriam of Magdala, or in English, Mary Magdalene.
Okay, gotcha.
So, this is, as I say, this is the evidence of that I have got, and one has to say that it is fairly minimal evidence, but such as it is, that's what it's pointing towards.
Okay, I see. And just to sneak that in there, I mean, the site, I think it's referred to as the cleft in the rock. Would you say that the site in Petra? I'm talking about the site in Petra, that incredible church that is...
Oh, the treasury.
Carved into the rock. Do you think that that was the headquarters, so to speak, of the time of the Nabataeans? Or...
Well, it was. I mean, there's actually a very interesting show which you can pick up on one or other. In fact, I picked it up only today, about Petra. I mean, Petra is about... There are two complete cities there, of which this sort of famous rock carving known as the temple, known as the treasury, is only a very small part. I mean, you know, it extends over something like 32 kilometers. And there is an upper and a lower city. And it was the headquarters of the Nabateans. And this is quite clear. I mean, that's we all know that.
Mm.
And that is quite clearly, archaeological finds and everything else. And indeed, of course, the Romans mentioned it, because the Romans took over Petra and the kingdom of Nabatea in, whatever it was, 32 AD or something. I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
32 BC, I beg your pardon.
Okay.
But it was a fantastic sort of a complete city. And then, of course, in 300 and something or other, there was an enormous earthquake, and half of the city was knocked down.
Mm, yes.
And then in 525, I think it was, there was a second earthquake when the rest of the city basically disappeared in dust. But, I mean, it was a fantastic city with a fantastic artisans and a wonderful culture, in fact, far higher than the Roman culture, that took over.
Hmm. That's interesting. And this is where the entire Petra dynasty, so to speak, probably were living, and that this is where their headquarter was, so to speak. And
indeed. And there's a thing called the Tomb of the Kings there,
mm-hmm.
Which presumably is where their kings were buried.
Okay. Very, very interesting. I mean, again, it's a wonderful site. I haven't been there myself yet. I hope to go there someday just to check it out, to see how big it is, and just see the incredible, you know, architecture that obviously is carved right into the rock. It's an incredible site. Have you been there, by the way?
No, I haven't. I mean, I was supposed to go there this year, but for reasons, well, various and sundry reasons, I couldn't get there.
Mm, okay.
Because I really wanted to go and see it. But having just seen this fantastic slideshow on the internet, I realise that probably, because you have to go an awful lot, you have to do an awful lot of walking there,
mm-hmm.
And I'm not quite sure that in my arthritic state I'm up to doing it anymore.
Ah, okay, well, that's a shame, but, yeah.
Mm. You know, there we are.
Okay. Okay, so we have, you know, many threads here, so to speak, that we can go off on tangents here to tie this together and speak more about this. I want to ask you a little bit more generally, I guess, if we tie it back again to Montgomery. Do you know if your family then has a specific lineage that is connected with the dynasties and the bloodlines that we have been talking about so far?
Well, let's put it this way. The Montgomerys were close cousins. In fact, they were third cousins to the family of the Dukes of Normandy, okay? And the Dukes of Normandy, as I've shown in my second book, The God Kings of England, descend from a guy called Ragnar Lothbrok, or Heraldus Brockus. He's got Harald Hiffeltine, he's got various names, Heraldus Brockus, etc. And the Montgomerys equally well descend from him. The first Montgomery's name was actually Ragnar Gormson,
mm-hmm.
Which became Latinized as Rogerius Gormericus. And eventually, when they built a little sort of hill fort in Normandy, and it became known as Mons Gormerici. And so we get the name Montgomery from there.
Hmm. Okay, that's interesting. And that's something I want to, you know, talk more about later on, maybe in the program, a little bit more about the possible importance of that and you know, why people even put the focus on this as they do. But we can return to that a little bit later and talk more about that. Maybe we can talk a little bit about the possible connections then between I guess we can refer to them as the Scandinavian lines here,
yep.
And let's take the Petran dynasty or some other more Middle Eastern line. Where, you know, do you have any clear idea about when, you know, when there was communication here? Were someone going from the west to the east, so to speak, or the other way around?
Okay.
What happened here?
All right, let's.
It's a tough question, I know.
It's a tough question for the sense that, as you know, this book, The God Kings of Outremer, is the last book of a trilogy, okay?
Mm.
Now, the trilogy goes from roughly 1100 BC to 1100 AD. And book one, which is The God Kings of Europe, starts off with the Kassite dynasty of Babylon.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And the first of the Odin, or the people called Odin, which was a king called Adad-shumah-iddina. Now, Iddina is simply another form of Odin or Wodin or Wotan, whatever you want to call it. And it simply means the one. And he was followed by Marduk-apla-iddina and Zababa-shumah-iddina. And they were the first three Odins. Okay?
Just a quick question here. Does this come from the Sumerian king list by any chance, these
yes.
names? Okay. Okay. Gotcha.
Okay. And in fact, in my book, The God Kings of Outremer, I give the Kassite dynasty king list.
Okay, yeah.
What then happened is that a hemorrhagic plague swept through Babylon, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And because of the way that sort of health and religion and godhead were all tied up, if your people became ill, the gods were no longer with you, therefore you had to leave. Either that or you got sort of killed or something.
Right.
So the Kassite dynasty left Babylon and they moved northwards. And we know that they stopped on the way at Troy, but eventually they finished up in Scandinavia.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, in sort of southern Scandinavia, Sweden, Ostergotland, Vestergotland, Iceland, and I think there's an island off the coast called Gotland, isn't there?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Now, they became known, of course, because they were so much more advanced than probably the people who were living there. They became known as the Got or Gota, the gods.
Hmm, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we can show that because in roughly 1100 BC, a mutation took place in amongst the Kassites, which is known as CCR5 Delta 32. And this particular mutation protects against the hemorrhagic plague.
Okay.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
It also helps protect, by the way, against HIV-1, which is interesting, which is why all of a sudden it became interesting to people today.
Really?
Yep.
Hmm, okay.
Now, the biggest concentration of that anywhere outside of Mesopotamia is in southern Sweden and Iceland.
Hmm.
And when the Vikings eventually came down south and started rampaging around the place, they took that mutation with them, and many of the descendants of the Vikings can prove it because they are CCR5 Delta 32 mutation. Hello?
Okay, yes, I hear you. Hmm?
So this is one of the ways that we can, that if you like, science is showing the documentary evidence.
And the genetic evidence, I guess.
And the genetic evidence, indeed.
So,
okay, so what then happened mm-hmm. is that the Goths then, as they then became known, came back south into Europe, where they split and became the Visigoths and the Ostrogoths.
Hmm.
And it is with the Visigoths that we then take up the tale, because the Visigoths, or one of their leaders, a guy called Atolf, married a woman called Maria of the Elchizites. Maria of the Elchizites claimed descent from the Davidic line of Israel via Jesus, or rather via his daughter.
Hmm.
And this is where the two tie in.
I see. And I just want to return, because I find it so interesting, this thing with the... you say, do you think it just was a spontaneous mutation that occurred, kept these people immune from later on than HIV-1, as you mentioned, but also from the what was the first ailment you mentioned?
The hemorrhagic plague.
Okay, there we go. Thank you. Okay.
Well, in point of fact, I mean, one of the interesting things they've now discovered is that the Black Death was not a bubonic plague, but was in fact a hemorrhagic plague.
Okay.
And the whole point about that was that when the Black Death hit that part of the world, all of a sudden, all these people were found to be immune to it. And in fact, the Icelandic saga Hinnljúdr actually says, in translation, these Sumerians were blessed by the gods because they were immune.
Yeah. Really, really interesting. And this, of course, as you mentioned, then must have been something that has been much interesting to in today as well regarding HIV. Is, do you know if there's any modern genealogical projects that are going on in order to find these genetic, you know, markers or whatever you call it?
Yes, there is.
There's
quite a number of them.
Okay, yeah.
There's a Viking DNA thing that's going on. Then there's a separate various Scottish clans like the Sinclairs have got their own DNA things going on. But there's also one that is being done by a couple of universities, actually not very far from where I live, on CCR5 Delta 32. So, you know, it is ongoing.
And are they successful, or is there progress in these?
I don't know.
Okay.
I am. I'm not a DNA expert.
Right.
So, all I can do is try and read what journals there may be on the question, and sort of try and understand them, and then usually email people and say, "Well, what does this actually mean?"
Right. Yeah. Just one more question on that, in regards to HIV. Then, do you know if that is still people then that are protected from HIV today that are alive? You know, they're just immune to it. I mean, this is a very difficult question as well. But have you researched it, anything?
I personally haven't, but I'm quite sure that the scientists who are concerned with it are beavering away on it, but they're not letting out anything at the moment. I mean, I suspect that one of the problems may be if they suddenly sort of announce that, well, guess what, all these people are not affected by HIV, that all this sort of business with the what should we say, the AIDS industry will all of a sudden disappear, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. So you might suspect here that this is something that isn't being publicly and openly talked about, as it were, perhaps.
I suspect you're quite right.
All right, right. It's always interesting. Okay, let's see here. I mean, maybe we can return and talk a little bit more about Odin, perhaps.
Yep.
The Odinic dynasty, as it were. We, of course, up here that this is just a mythological character, of course, but I guess that you're saying that this is to the contrary, correct? You're talking about Woden.
No, I think what happened is that the original people were, if you like, god-kings. God-kings of Babylon. Now, by the time they got up to southern Scandinavia, this was, 600 years later, maybe more? Now, over that period, these beings, if you like, had become mythologized as gods. And you got this, the idea that Odin was, you know, rode a six-footed horse or something, and he had a big spear, and he had ravens on his shoulder, and he lost an eye at the well of whatever it was, and so on. But I think that this is a typical mythologization of, you know, 600 years. Well, they vaguely remember that they were somewhere off in somewhere else. But really, they haven't got much clue about it anymore because it's all been handed down by tradition. It gets changed in the oral tradition as it goes along. And people add to them, and the epic poets all like to make big things about it and so on. So they add bits to it. And so we got this mythology, if you like, of who Odin was. But originally, I have no doubt whatsoever that the original Odin was a Kassite king in Mesopotamia.
And do you think that he came up to this area around when he was alive, or did the myth
spread
on?
No, certainly not.
Okay.
The point about it is that the Odin became a title. And for example, you get Rus the Völun God, which simply means, you know, Rus the Odin God. Well, that he wasn't a god. That was his title. And he was sort of, you know, chief of his dynasty or whatever it was. So that each chief or king or whatever it might be of the dynasty would call himself Odin.
Hmm. Okay, as a title, yeah, I see what you mean.
And, you know, I think over the years there have been hundreds of Odins.
Hmm, yeah. That's very interesting. And so this is, when do you think that this happened, if we're talking about time here? How long did it take for this to spread up to the Scandinavian region and these kings that slowly came up?
About 600 plus years.
About 600 years, okay, I see. Okay, it's very interesting. And
I mean, you know, to a large extent, we're guessing because,
of course,
we only have got two places where we know they stopped, because they actually, you know, there are archaeological records that they wrote down.
Okay, and these are
one of them being Troy, and the other one being somewhere in North Germany. There's a little sort of stone which is now in the museum in Aberdeen, I think it is. And those are the only two places that we've actually got any archaeological evidence, if you like, for the Kassites having got that far.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's really interesting. And again, you were saying that, just to clarify this, the reason for their migration, so to speak, this was mainly because of disease and lack of you know, falling of crops, or was there some kind of catastrophe? What do you think?
I think it was simply a hemorrhagic plague, which of course would have played havoc with the population.
Mm.
And so they had the people that they regarded as being responsible for it, in other words, their kings, because they were the god kings, had to move out. And so they would have taken, you know, all their servants, and they'd have taken food on the hoof, like goats and so on. They'd have had their wheeled chariots with their ponies or horses, and they'd have taken off with them. But by the time they got to Scandinavia, I mean, they were no longer Kassites. I mean, let's be clear about it. You know, they would have intermarried on the way. They'd have had cultural acclimatization, all these other sorts of things that go on.
Yes.
So that by the time they got to Scandinavia, they were... All their previous history would have been sort of oral mythology.
Hmm. That's really interesting. So they were, we can possibly say that they in some fashion were expelled from their homeland, and they went on an exodus, as it were.
Effectively, yes.
Hmm. Really interesting. And this took a long time. Do you think that they had great knowledge, you know, about, you know, science, farming, things like this that they took with them?
They would have certainly known about farming. They would have certainly known about animal husbandry.
Mm.
They had writing, certainly. You know, they had the cuneiform script. So they were able to write things down. And they would certainly have known things like navigation by the stars and astronomy and that sort of thing. How much they knew, well... I don't know.
Because there are, you know, for instance, I was talking with an kind of an alternative, I guess you can say, archaeologist a couple of weeks ago, months ago, I think it was now, and he's talked about their recent findings on you know, Phoenician scripture, for instance, up here in Sweden. And this is possibly something that have been taken with some of these fellers up here, possibly. I don't know, but that could be the case then, I guess.
Well, if you think about it, you think of the runic script, and then you look at it and compare it with cuneiform.
Mm.
And although it's not identical, it's very similar.
It is, actually, yeah.
Now, you know, I'm not saying it meant the same thing, that the meanings of the various, you know, lines and what have you were the same. But the fact that someone worked out the same type of script is, I would have thought, significant.
Absolutely, and this is a common held theory that it all goes back to one root language, if you will, that slowly has developed and obviously spread, and you have different versions of it basically throughout the world today. You know, so
yep.
Absolutely, that's really interesting. How about this this line that you write about in your latest book about the Ulvungar dynasty. Maybe you can tell us about that.
I love that, because of course I pronounce it Ulvungar, but yes, you're absolutely right, Ulvungar.
And
that would be the more correct. I mean, for example, I can never remember which country it is in Scandinavia, that you have one of the royal dynasties is called the Folkunga.
Folkunga, definitely. Folkunga dynasty.
Where is that?
I'm not sure, actually. I need to read up on that myself.
Oh, well, you don't know, then I don't feel so bad. Okay, and there's also one called the Yngling dynasty, yes?
Say that again.
Yngling?
Yngling.
Y-N-G. Yngling, yet? England.
Yngling et then. Yeah, sure. Okay, I got you. Yeah.
Okay, yes. Right. Now, that simply means the younger branch.
Yeah, it does.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, well, the Folkunga and the Ulvunga are the same dynasty.
Okay.
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 They simply mean the folk of Ulf.
Yes.
Now, Atta Ulf, of course, was originally called Ulf. Okay? Atta simply means the father or the ancestor, Ulf. Just as, for example, Mustafa Kemal became Ataturk, father of the Turks.
Right.
So Atta Ulf simply means the father Ulf, or the ancestor Ulf, because they descend from him.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. So it's the dynasty of Ulf, if you like, or Atta Ulf and Maria, who become the Ulvungars. However, what one has to remember is that the Visigothic empire extended right across Europe and into Britain and Scandinavia. And, for example, the Mercian dynasty was Visigothic. And Uther, as he was known in Mercia, was actually king of Mercia before he became head of the Visigoths. And his sister married Alaric of the Visigoths. And probably, though I don't know definitely, but probably Ulf went with his sister to her wedding to Alaric. And then when Alaric decided to go and sack Rome, he thought it was too good an opportunity to miss to have a bit of plunder, so he went with him.
Okay.
And of course Alaric died, and all of a sudden he found himself head of the Visigoths as well as being king of Mercia.
So he controlled a large empire, as it were, at that point.
An enormous empire.
Yeah.
Yes. And I mean, one of the interesting things, and you get this, for example, in the Annals of Fulda, that the Normans, when they sort of came down as Viking raiders into France, they didn't think of themselves as Viking raiders. They were actually trying to take back the land that, as far as they were concerned, was theirs.
Okay.
And you actually get, in the Annals of Fulda, admission that, you know, various Vikings sort of said, well, excuse me, you're supposed to be paying us taxes, we're your overkings. You know, and this Danegelt business was not so much sort of paying them off. It was a question of, well, you know, what do we do? Because, yes, in some cases, the Annals of Fulda actually say that certain Vikings who were related to King Horik of Denmark, for example, owned not only benefices within what we would now call Germany, Frisia, but also actually had allodial lands, in other words, inherited lands there.
Okay.
So, you know, all this business of well, the Vikings were terrible people who came down and sort of raped their way across Europe, not strictly true.
I see what you mean. It's an interesting point.
Because it was the Romans who'd pushed them out of their lands, and they were trying to get them back again.
Yeah, I see what you mean. So there's, you're saying that there was, you know, obviously huge conflicts going on between the Visigoths, as it were, and the Romans at the time, and battling for the land, battling for, you know, who gets to control the largest empire in the world, as it were.
Absolutely. And it went on, and this is the point, and this is the point I make in my third book, The God Kings of Outremer. Eventually, they finish up controlling Scandinavia, southern Italy, and eventually right into Outre-mer, which is, of course, Palestine, what the French call, or the Western knights called Palestine, Outre-mer, over the sea.
Okay.
And finished up going back, if you like, and conquering the very lands that the Romans, and the sort of centre of the Roman Empire from which they'd been evicted X number of hundred years before.
Interesting. And when approximately are we in time here?
Well, I mean, that is that the Kingdom of Jerusalem was sort of 1100 odd AD. And in fact, I mean, I got to about 1120, I think it is, with the sort of formation of the Kingdom of Jerusalem and the Knight Templars. And basically, that's where I leave it.
Okay, now I see what you mean.
That's the apogee.
Okay.
Like of the Ulvunga dynasty.
Okay, now I see what you mean. So this is where very tied in. But I mean, this could be seen as the Roman reconquest as well of the same lands. I mean, this could be seen that because again the intermarrying that has been going on and the way that the cultures and the nations, so to speak, the people have mingled, it must be very difficult to, because I would consider obviously that the First Crusade is a you know Roman slash you know European French type of thing going on where they are interested in getting hold of the land of Jerusalem or Palestine as it were.
Oh, absolutely true. But, for example, if you have a look at the people who, first of all, you know, in 1095, Urban II so-called preached the First Crusade, okay? But if you look carefully at the documents, he didn't just preach the First Crusade. He actually went and visited a few people on the way. Okay, and he visited Adhemar, Bishop of Le Puy, and Raymond of Toulouse. Both of them were Ulvunga descendants.
Okay.
And who were the leaders of the crusade? Raymond of Toulouse, Hugh de Vermandois, Robert of Normandy, Godfrey of Bouillon, Bohemond of Taranto. Every single one of them an Ulvunga. Surprise, surprise. Now, if you had it once, that's an accident. Have it twice, it's a coincidence. Five times, come on.
All right. That's really interesting. So, but I mean, these people were Christian, you know, right? Or are you saying that there's something else going on here behind the scenes, behind the veil of...
In order to hold any land and be a noble, you had to be a Christian.
Why? Why?
But what your beliefs in private were may have been different.
Okay, but this is...
No, I'm not saying there were.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying that there may have been.
There may have been,
because
okay.
One of the things that I am absolutely sure about is that the House of Normandy knew from whom they descended.
Okay.
They had documents. Mm.
But they're are saying that they're answering to the Pope, and that's why they have had to be Christian on the surface, at least.
Yes, until, of course, they'd actually taken over Jerusalem, and guess what then they did? They got their own man in, Calixtus II, as Pope, and he was an Ulvunga.
Okay. Really, really interesting. I think, Hugh, that this is a good time here to begin to round things up for the first segment. But before we do that, Hugh, I just want you to mention your website or websites for us, of course, and where people would best go to get a copy of your titles, and mention a few of your titles again for us, for people who are interested.
Okay, they are The God Kings of Europe, The God Kings of England, and The God Kings of Outre-mer. And you should be able to get all of them on Amazon. If you want the websites, you can go to http://humantgumray.blogspot.com.
Very good. Okay, and we will have this linked up again on redicecreations.com with links and links to the books, of course, for people who are interested. Thank you very much for this segment, Hugh. We're going to continue then in a little while talking more in our member section, but we'll take a short break and we'll return shortly.
Jolly good. Thanks very much.
Stay tuned to the Red Ice member section as we'll continue talking more with Hugh Montgomery about the origins of the Babylonian kings, the Ulvungar dynasty, the royal houses of Europe, and the importance, if any, of the descendants of Jesus. We'll discuss what the importance or the why this is so special. We'll also talk about the genealogical research that is going on, DNA, the Da Vinci Code, Priory of Sion, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and we'll round things up discussing Ethiopia, the dynasties of the Black Madonna, Jerusalem, and the Temple of Solomon, and much more. So don't miss our continuation. Head on over to redicecreations.com for all the details on how to tune in. Also, an important notice for all of you out there who are making your own music. We're interested in playing it on Red Ice Radio. Go to our radio archive, click on Bumper Music at the top, and read more about all the details and how to send us your music. Thank you for listening to part one. We'll be back after this break.
There's gotta be a record of you someplace. You gotta be on somebody's books. The lowdown picture of your face, your injured looks, the sacred and profane, pleasure and the pain. Somewhere your fingerprints remain concrete. And it's your face I'm looking for on every street. A lady killer, regulation tattoo, silver spurs on his heel. What can I tell you as I'm standing next to you? She threw herself under my wheels. And it's a dangerous road, and a hazardous load. When the fireworks over liberty explode in the heat, and it's your face I'm looking for on every street. On it.